Hey, this episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Sunset Lake CBD. Sunset Lake CBD is located in Vermont, just outside of Burlington. They're a farm that used to provide dairy for Ben & Jerry's ice cream. I think they still do, but they decided to diversify. They're working with the University of Vermont on regenerative farming practices. They use 100% pesticide-free and only organic fertilizers when it comes to growing their CBD. You can look at the third-party test to see the purity for their products at sunsetlakecbd.com. They have great business practices, $15 an hour for their workers as a minimum wage, I should say. Employees own the majority of the company, but more importantly than, well, I don't know if it's more importantly than all that, but in terms of the product, we were all CBD skeptics around here. I know I was, and all I had really done is tried the tinctures and this and that, and I just never found them to be terribly effective. Sunset Lake CBD, they're fans of the show. They sent me some products, and I was like, this actually works. It helps me sleep. Then I ended up using the salve for my eczema. I sent the salve to friends. One guy who had shingles, he had back pain, helped. Got emails from people saying it helped with their arthritis. And then Matt, who is a smoker guy, said the smokables.
Yep.
You were very anti-CBD back
then. I was. I had a bad Venice Beach CBD experience, but...
Who hasn't had a bad Venice Beach CBD experience?
But yeah, the small product line, I'm a big fan of.
So there's smokables, there's gummy bears, and they have gummies, I think, are 1,000 meg. They have a tincture now that's 3,000 meg. They have coffee beans that are infused with CBD, which great tasting coffee, but also takes the edge off a little bit. Smoking CBD is actually an incredible experience. I never realized it, but you get that sort of like physical high, right? Is that the way you describe it, Matt? You get the physical high, but you don't get you don't get paranoid.
Yeah. More of a body high.
Body high. Check it out. Use the coupon code left is best at sunsetlakecbd.com. You get 20% off your order. They're fans of the show. Left is best. One word, left is best. In fact, somebody sent me the video of the left is best where that meme started. And it was actually pretty fun. That's almost 4 years ago now. sunsetlakecbd.com. Left is best. 20% off. Check it out. Start the show.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 11th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I'm here in a soft-collared shirt. And joining me for the entire program today is one of two candidates for the congressional seat in the 14th District of California. Shahid Buttar challenging Nancy Pelosi for that congressional seat. Also on the program today, congratulations to Nancy Pelosi. She managed to give away the continuing resolution. The government will stay open, but there will be absolutely zero economic aid for the over 30 million jobless and growing in this country. Never mind our cities, our states, our schools, etc. I have a feeling that might come up today. Meanwhile, we have unprecedented wildfires raging in California and the Northwest. dozens killed, thousands evacuated, and it's just the beginning of the season. Donald Trump brags he saved MBS's ass. It was obvious, but it's nice to hear him say it. And the Trump administration secretly has been withholding millions of dollars from the New York Fire Department 9/11 Health Fund. OSHA fines a meat processor $10 per COVID infection and nothing for the four deaths and 43 hospitalizations brought about by unsafe work conditions there. In a preview of what's to come, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court delays mail-in ballots being sent out to voters. ProPublica has a report. Abusive NYPD cops have moved up the ranks to the highest positions in the New York Police Department. And there's a blackout. We have no mechanism to track COVID infections in schools in this country. Federal court blocks Trump's attempt to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census. You remember the census. That's a constitutionally mandated counting of every single individual in the country, regardless of what their citizenship status is. And Chris Coons gives us a preview of Democratic corporate giveaways that we can expect more of, presumably, once he has an opportunity to be in the majority in the Senate. All this and more on today's program. And a correction, I'm sorry. When we bring him on, Shahid Buttar is, of course, in the 12th congressional district running for challenging Nancy Pelosi, who is the longtime congresswoman there. And of course, she is also the Speaker of the House. Let's get to this first, because the, you know, like I say, there's nothing particularly earth-shatteringly new in the revelations from Bob Woodward, or at least ones that you wouldn't glean if you were, you know, you paying attention. But the fact of the matter is the vast majority of Americans don't pay that much of attention to the news. And hearing Donald Trump say in his own voice in February that, yeah, no, this is much worse than the flu. This is five times, the death rate is five times more. And it's not just about touching stuff. It's in the air. Hearing him say that really, I would imagine, is going to impact some votes. At the very least, it is not unreasonable to speculate what would have happened had we heard that at the time in terms of like just the messaging that would have been forced upon the Trump administration in terms of like, hey, wait a second. This is all about the air. This is five times. People have to take this seriously. We heard you say it on the tape. I mean, I think there's a decent argument it could have saved thousands of lives. And frankly, I think we would be in much better shape in terms of sending our kids to schools. It would have given leverage to the scientists. Instead of, you can read now articles about how the CDC was completely sitting there, a perfect target to be rolled and essentially degraded because they had no political acumen. And this would have provided at least some basis to push back on the Trump administration. But Tucker Carlson has a different take. And here it is.
That for repeated interviews with Bob Woodward. Why in the world would he do that? Well, tonight, from a source who knows the answer to that mystery, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. It was Lindsey Graham who helped convince Donald Trump to talk to Bob Woodward. Lindsey Graham brokered that meeting. Lindsey Graham even sat in on the first interview between Bob Woodward and the president. How'd that turn out? Now, remember, Lindsey Graham is supposed to be a Republican, so why would he do something like that? You'd have to ask him. But keep in mind that Lindsey Graham has opposed, passionately opposed, virtually every major policy initiative that Donald Trump articulated when he first ran. from ending illegal immigration to pulling back from pointless wars to maintaining law and order at home. Lindsey Graham was against all of that more than many Democrats. So maybe you already know the answer.
Wow. Of course, it also begs the question, how did Lindsey Graham manage to do a 180 on all those things that he was supposedly so concerned about? But that's not what Tucker Carlson's about. I have no problem with Tucker Carlson sinking Lindsey Graham and dropping him and having a Jamie Harrison win that Senate seat in South Carolina. But the bottom line is, since we're talking about Bob Woodward, I guess I'm glad that Bob Woodward recorded this and we'll put that down for posterity. I imagine in the absence of that Bob Woodward thing, I don't know. Maybe we'd be on to a different scandal that Donald Trump was involved in. But the idea that this guy should be praised for holding on to this information. Now, people forget this because I haven't seen anybody mention this, but I remember it distinctly. He did the same exact thing with George W. Bush. He had inside information. He had gone in and done a lot of reporting. He didn't release it until after the 2005 election because he had a book to monetize. Period. End of story. And at that time, he was working as a reporter for the Washington Post. So he specifically did not put it into his stories. Stuff that he knew that was going on in the White House. Stuff that was arguably illegal. Stuff that showed massive incompetence. And he held that stuff for his book after 2005. Now, I'll tell you why I remember this so vividly is because I was quite angry about it at the time. And I was starting my nascent radio career. And I was asked to MC a theatrical reading of All the President's Men. I guess Billy Crudup was there because I went back and I looked at that. I had no idea. I still wouldn't know him if he was in this room, but I guess I recognized the name. But there was a bunch of other actors, I think some very prominent actors. And Carl Bernstein was playing a role as well. So there was like, so I went up on stage and I said, very excited that Carl Bernstein's here and all these actors. I can't remember the prominent names. And I said, it's apropos that Bob Woodward's not here because the Bob Woodward of this era is gone. The Bob Woodward of the era that exists today is one who's going to monetize this stuff and put that over the put his ability to monetize and build his own career and rank that as more important than actually informing the public and in timely fashion where they can actually act upon the information that he is presenting. And I walked off stage. All the actors came up. There was, I don't know, about 15 or 20 of them. They all lined up and sat down on chairs. They started to go in on the script. And when Carl Bernstein, who was like playing a small role, when they got to him, he stopped it. And he said, I have to address with the comments that guy said. And he ripped me a new a-hole. And then they continued on with the whole thing. I think you can find that in the New York Post. But the bottom line is, Bob Woodward used this information to bolster his book sales. And 8 months ago, we don't know if it would have saved lives. But it's really hard to imagine it wouldn't have impacted any of it. If it's important now, imagine what it would have been then. It wouldn't have sold his books, fair enough. It may not have been as, you know, utilized in the political campaign, but it literally would have saved thousands of lives and probably saved part of the economy and certainly would be making it easier for kids to go back to school at this point. Had this been taken seriously from the beginning, had the Trump administration, by his own words, had been held to that standard and understanding of what this was that we were dealing with, it's very hard to imagine that we wouldn't have heard something that it wouldn't have impacted the way our government and our society responded to this. I'm sorry. I mean, it's almost impossible to believe. And certainly, Bob Woodward making that decision in that moment couldn't have come to the conclusion this wouldn't mean anything in terms of the way that we respond to this disease. So, put that in Bob Woodward's pipe and smoke it, if you will. I get a couple ads here. Oh, and speaking of this coronavirus time, there's been a lot of changes in my life. One of them has been I use a bidet. I mean, I'll use it in the office, but at home I do now. Wow. And for, I guess, you know, for many people around the world, it's the most obvious thing in the world to do. For years, bidets have been available, but hideously expensive. They've cost thousands of dollars. Well, I want to welcome you to Hello Tushy. It's a modern bidet attachment. It was super easy to put on, and it's here to democratize the blessings bestowed by bidets and offer, if you will, clean buttholes to everyone. Hello Tushy cleans your butt with a precise stream of fresh water for $79. You get multiple cleanings for that. In fact, a lifetime, if you will. It attaches to your existing toilet, requires no electricity, no additional plumbing. It cuts toilet paper use by 80%. The Hello Tushy bidet pays for itself in a few months. And when there's the next run on toilet paper, you're okay. What happens, you don't wipe at all. Even the best two-ply can't cut it when it comes to hands-free poop experience. Ditched paper products and uncomfortable chafing when you switch to the soothing, cleansing stream of water from a Hello Tushy bidet. And every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can join millions of people who are happy Hello Tushy customers right now and have a clean butt with every flush. Look, this is what you do. It's a piece that's like about this big. It attaches between the toilet seat and the toilet bowl. You unscrew it. You can do it with the unscrewing the thing. You don't even need any tools. You need one wrench to come in with the water, intercept it before it goes into the toilet bowl. It's super easy to do. It took about maybe 20 minutes to hook up. You hook it up. It works automatically. There's no electricity involved in this thing. It's just a function of the water that's already there. You go to HelloTushy.com/majority. You get 10% off. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. If you've ever met anybody who has switched to a bidet, they don't stop talking about it for like a half an hour because it's that much of a revelation. So check it out. Meanwhile, thousands of business owners also during this coronavirus have discovered the benefits of stamps.com. They've been able to keep their businesses running. They've been able to avoid the crowds at the post office, all from their own computers. Stamps.com brings all the mailing and shipping services you need right to your computer in the comfort of your home or office, whether you're a small business sending invoices, you're an online seller shipping out products, whether you're, let's say, a 15-year-old girl selling the clothes that your dad gives you on Depop and then thinking that you're a business mogul because you're making all this money at 100% profit. Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. I'm not implying anything, but I'm just telling you, this has been my experience. You use your computer to print out official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send. Once your mail is ready, you just leave it for your mail carrier. You can schedule a pickup or you drop it off in a mailbox. You also get great discounts with stamps.com, 5 cents off every stamp and up to 62% of USPS and UPS shipping rates and no residential surcharges. Stamps.com, no brainer. Saves you time, saves you money. Right now, listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Majority Report. That's stamps.com, Majority Report. And lastly, look, I get a lot of questions throughout the year, particularly towards this time of year, but throughout the year, what's a good charity for me to give to? What's one that's going to actually have some impact? And people are looking for all like a wide range of stuff. And sometimes I know what to tell them. Sometimes I don't. Every year, there's millions of people who suffer from easily preventable diseases. There's people who suffer from enormous poverty. There's people who suffer from a whole myriad of problems. When you want to give some money and you want to know where it's going to have the most impact, check out givewell.org. For over 10 years, GiveWell.org has helped donors find the charities and projects that save and improve lives the most per dollar. They're totally transparent on how they calculate this. They give you a list of recommended charities. You can go back and you can look in their archives and see what they have recommended over the past 10 years. And they dedicate over 20,000 hours a year to researching charitable organizations. They handpick, like I say, a small ones of the highest impact, evidence-based backed charities. GiveWell isn't asking for your donations themselves. They're asking you to give to these charities they recommend. The Helen Keller International Against and Against Malaria Foundation are a couple. GiveWell.org takes no fees. So all of your tax-deductible donation will be to help others. That's I found on GiveWell. The one that I give from GiveWell is Give Directly. It's basically very straightforward. You give cash. And you give cash and it goes directly to poor individuals in several countries in Africa. It is the, I think, the most proven way of raising people out of poverty is to actually just give them money. And those folks know exactly how to use it in a way that will better their lives. So you can check that out. And that's why I use GiveWell. You can find others there that you like. If you have, if you want to have more impact, donate soon. Any of our listeners who become new GiveWell donors will have their first donation matched up to $100. So when you select podcast and Majority Report at checkout, you'll get a $100 matching gift to the charity of your choice. This matching offer is good for as long as these funds last. Check it out last. All of these will be linked in our podcast description and in our YouTube description. All right, I want to bring to the program, hopefully, the next congressperson from the 12th District in California, making his return visit to the Majority Report. Shahid Buttar, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It's great to be with you.
Now, look, I want to start off. I think the last time you were here was, I don't know, maybe at the beginning of the summer. There was a piece in The Intercept. I think it was reported other places. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I need to raise it so that we can move on with this. There were a couple of set of accusations. One of them, which was frankly the more serious one, and I think really the peg for the story, fell apart very quickly, even in the context of the story. And I think, you know, we're talking about somebody who I think is a little bit troubled. I don't want to go into that for her sake, frankly, more than anything else. But there were other accusations that I think it was by three campaign staffers, two women, one man, that you were, you know, like a jerk as a boss. It wasn't, we're not talking, Klobuchar level stories here, but, you know, that you were very demanding, that sometimes you would yell at people, I guess, or not yell, but dress them down in certain situations. Now, also in this same report, it was clear that there was a sort of overhaul of your campaign staff. And since that point, things, your campaign has improved by a whole series of metrics that are out there. But I need to raise it. Some of it people felt was a little gendered. Other people were like, well, you just sort of jerked to everybody in, you know, that were complaining. I've seen, and also let me just add this. There was a woman named Gloria Berry, who's the chair of the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee and Black Lives Matter Committee. She came out and basically said, like, I think the people who are complaining are a little dubious. I know these people and it was a bad fit. Just to give both sides, but I want to give you an opportunity to say a few words of it and then we'll move on. And I just want to say to my audience, I've dug into this stuff with all due respect to you. I wouldn't have you on if I felt that it was, if there was a real problem here, but I want to give you an opportunity to just address it.
Thank you for that. And for raising it, just to be clear, I take the issues at stake here really seriously, because gender matters, race matters, inclusion matters, and ensuring that everybody's respected in the workplace, all those things matter. And I particularly appreciate you raising the question. You are literally the first journalist in the nearly 2 months since these stories reported to even mention Gloria Berry's name. And she's been entirely silenced by the press. This is one of three people recruited by my former staff to participate in which one of those supporters of mine described in text messages that the press has seen and generally suppressed as a smear campaign. And there have been almost half a dozen different accusations, you know, before, and in fact, referenced in that Intercept article is a DSA resolution predicated on a false rumor started by my former colleagues that I had a pattern of inappropriate activity with my volunteers. And that fell apart even before that story was ever printed, even though it references this DSA resolution that at the time was being promoted by people who knew that the narrative they were presenting in public was false. And then after that was this accusation of harassment by someone who had previously accused me of murder, of human trafficking. The same person had accused any number of people of similar things. The same person had been, frankly, accused by other people of doing precisely what she said I did to her. And this was the person that my former colleagues used to get their concerns about my campaign strategy into the press. And you know, Gloria's voice is one among several that I think is really critical here, because the claims about my supposed toxicity in the workplace don't at least align with the experiences of either people who work with me now or any of the volunteers who've been with me long before those former staff joined me. I've been running for Congress for 3 years. Among the people who've been critical of me in the press, the longest any of them worked with me was 9 months. Some of them only worked with me for a few weeks. And, you know, these are people who have political motivations. It's unfortunate to me that the press amplified stories without checking the facts. And I'm particularly disappointed if there was a role or a particular part in all this I'd, you know, really emphasize. There's one group. I've been endorsed by a whole series of organizations here in San Francisco, the SF Tenants Union, Democratic Socialists of America, Progressive Democrats of America, the SF Bernie-crats, local members of the school board and the board of supervisors. Every single one of them, with one exception, rescinded their endorsements after these allegations were brought forward. And the only group that stuck by me is the one group that actually did an investigation, which is to say the entire city's progressive establishment presumed the accusations to be true in spite of evidence and witnesses to the contrary. And as a person of color, falsely accused and presumptively judged in public, it is disturbing to me to see self-described progressive and even socialist organizations fail to recognize long-established dynamics in our society. And, you know, at the end of the day, what the impact of this campaign, the smears towards me has been, is to neutralize the progressive establishment in San Francisco, which, frankly, the institutional part of the progressive establishment from which my former colleagues came and to which they've returned since leaving my campaign, it's always supported Pelosi. But the parts of it that at least did not have taken themselves off the table. So I'm going into this election in November against the sitting Speaker of the House with a great deal at stake for our entire civilization. And every self-described socialist or progressive organization in San Francisco has basically taken themselves off the table, not based on anything I did, but on the presumption that I had done things, all kinds of things. And just to be clear, my former colleagues, in addition to accusing me of this pattern of inappropriate behavior, this supposed harassment by the person whose veracity, you know, we've discussed, they've also said I don't work hard, which is just, I mean, it's laughable. I don't even know what to say about that. I'm the first Democrat in a generation to face Pelosi in a general election. That doesn't happen by me sitting on my hands.
Right.
It certainly didn't happen, you know, through the work with people who were with me for just a few weeks. I mean, it's the support and the supporters who put me there. And maybe the biggest part, and maybe another thing I'd say here, it is very challenging to be dragged in public for things I haven't done, especially as a person of color, being subjected to racial and religious tropes. But to see the suspension of any commitment to due process or innocence or facts, and instead to presume the legitimacy of any accusation, I think does very dangerous things to our movement. Because while I've been the target of these false claims, it is the movement that's borne the brunt of it. And ultimately, that's what I'm committed to. I'm grateful for all the support from people who have paid enough attention to examine the facts. And I do want to particularly just note that the failures of the local press to me are especially alarming here. And they're not confined to this story. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, for instance, hasn't debated a challenger in a generation. And that's entirely because the local press hasn't held her accountable.
Right.
And similarly, the local press here didn't report any facts. They didn't all the text messages documenting that my former colleagues knew they were presenting a false narrative at the time that they were reaching out to the press. All the local press outlets saw those texts, and not a single one of them would correct their stories. Even The Intercept, which went back to its story a month after publishing it to basically rewrite the story, didn't issue a correction in violation of their own editorial guidelines. We had to go back to them to get them to just fix the headline. And even the story itself at the first instance, when they first wrote it, was internally inconsistent. There's all kinds of fact errors through it. And I just see the crisis in journalism beyond the crisis in race as independent objects of alarm. And I think a lot of people, frankly, have paid attention to one layer of this controversy. But
I think, you know, my sense is there was also some internal stuff going on at The Intercept, even in that piece. I mean, first of all, if you read that piece from July 23rd, it basically says, here's a person who is accusing you of something who everyone around them says is troubled, frankly. And that, in fact, you were being accused of something that their former roommate had happened to them that they had told this person who was accusing you. So the whole thing, that whole element of it fell apart within the story that they're presenting. But that was the tent pole in which the other accusations, which clearly on themselves would not have merited a story, were presented. And to me, the thing, I got to be honest with you, it felt a lot like what happened with Alex Morse. Fortunately for Alex Morse, there was they were just more rigorous. And also, I will say this, just totally coincidentally, a big part of why the Alex Morse fell apart was because we got an email from somebody who was periphery to that and ended up being the basis of a lot of the investigations that came out afterwards for The Intercept that we handed over. And so I think, you know, from my perspective, that made me that much more skeptical about that story. And at the very least, I did some digging around in that and pursued it. And I think, if someone was to spend that time, and like I say, I wouldn't have you on if I hadn't felt confident in what I had read there. So, or had researched, but okay. So
thanks for breaking your piece in the Moore story. I didn't realize your role there, but there is a close similarity.
I don't know if I've been that explicit about it up until this moment, but it was really. You know, we have listeners, and we had one who was a student who happened to be up in that area, in one of the schools. And I think I know reporters, and we don't have the ability to report out things, but we just hand it off. But
you might have just done the same thing with me. I mean, you are the first journalist to even mention Gloria Berry's name. And just one point of potential correction, she's not the chair of the local Democratic County Committee, but she is elected to it. She sits on the chair, and we met. One of the ways we met was at a DCCC meeting about a year and a half ago, where we were both on our feet after one of the members of the DCCC dropped the N-word half a dozen times within 30 seconds. And so she understands all too well the long history of race in the city. And she's had very poignant words publicly in response to the accusations made towards me. She was in one of the DSA meetings in particular, where just people had the most vicious slander that they were throwing at me. And she wrote publicly afterward that she felt like she just left a KKK rally. Huh. And this is not something that San Francisco's establishment has grappled with or even considered. Her voice has been entirely suppressed. So just thank you so much for even bringing her into the conversation, because the suppression of an Afro-Latino voice that was, frankly, very close to my campaign, saw all the issues that went down, understands that what my former colleagues describe as abuse was simply conflict between a candidate with a strategic vision and a cadre of paid campaign staff who had their own vision. And then the idea that after, I finally got them off the team, moved to more experienced staff who share my vision, and then the folks who I replaced show up months later with this set of stories, shifting stories every week. And she heard the lies and tried to expose them, and no one was willing to listen to her. And so I appreciate you at least.
You can just find it by Googling, and it's a Medium piece that she wrote, at least, one of these, she lays it out convincingly, in my opinion. But let's talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi and the reasons why you are running. And I got to tell you, from my perspective, and look, there's two sets of issues here, right? One is the local implications. From my perspective, I'm not going to have somebody who's running for a specific local office for a backbencher on the program a couple of times, regardless of how much I like that person or appreciate the way they're running. It's just, you know, but, and I say this as someone who, when there was a leadership challenge to Nancy Pelosi a couple of years ago, that I thought she was best situated to be the leader. You know, someone like Tim Ryan, I don't like his politics at all. And I was worried about him being the leader. I have since come around to the point where I would rather have a leader whose politics I don't like, who is not as good at shutting down the rest of their caucus, frankly, because Nancy Pelosi is quite adept at maintaining power. And I'm not quite convinced that her politics are, mine are as aligned as I might've thought. When I look at things like the Heroes Act, I mean, there's two major things and I want you to address them.
Yeah.
One is, and working backwards, one is the Heroes Act. This was a messaging bill. Fine. $3 trillion bill. Fine. It excluded things like automatic stabilizers, which, because supposedly it would have pushed it to a $4 trillion, I don't know if I've ever met a human being who would be like, well, $3 trillion is okay, but $4 trillion, that's way too much. Like, there's no, you know, nobody can conceive of those numbers anyways, but that's supposedly the reason why it was there. I'm skeptical about that, because this bill supposedly is going to work as two things. One, we passed this stuff and it's in there. And the other is it lays a marker for where the Democratic Party can go in the event that they take power. The other thing is that instead of let's have people come on Medicare if they've lost their job, we have 30 million people who have lost their jobs, tens of million people, you know, or almost 10 million people have lost their health insurance that were tied into their employment. Some have gone into Medicaid. But these other people need to be dealt with. You could just have them come right into Medicare. You could have them come into Medicaid for that matter. They promoted the subsidizing of COBRA, which if you're worried about money on one hand, that you can't have economic stabilizers in there saying that these programs are not going to run out until certain thresholds are met. How do you turn around and then pay for the single most expensive form of health insurance maybe created in the history of man? I mean, literally, there's no other way to pay more for health insurance than to subsidize COBRA from a government or, frankly, from an individual. That's one of the big problems I have. And the other problem is, and there were many people saying this contemporaneously, I had a couple on this show. When they passed the CARES Act, that was the only time there was leverage. The Republicans wanted that trillions of dollars of backstop from the Fed. They wanted the corporate money to go out there. There was nothing else on the Republican wish list. And I mean, so much so that they had to manufacture this whole like corporate indemnity, which there hasn't been a rash of suits against corporations. That's not, I really think that's sort of kabuki. But this is her job. She has one job because she cannot force anything through a Republican Senate. The only thing that she can do is to assess where is the leverage that the Democrats have and use that leverage to get things that are absolutely crucial and assess whether the Republicans down the road are going to give it. We are looking at such a massive crisis now with cities and states in particular. It's all going to happen and the Republicans are going to do nothing about it. They're going to do nothing about it. And it's going to inhibit Joe Biden's attempt to even get elected, I think, on some level because of what they're doing to blue states. There's no money for voter protection. There was one opportunity, one bite at the apple, and she was so indignant when people brought this up that we have video. Let's play this video, and then I want you to address both these issues. This is, again, this is her with Jake Tapper. This was indicative of what she was saying even a month after the CARES Act was passed. Let's play this clip.
Right. You and Senator Schumer made this major concession on the most recent legislation because you
was
made
it okay.
Oh, and pause it. I'm sorry. Pause it. This was when they came back for the second bite at the Paycheck Protection Program, which is a program that allowed for small businesses to get extended paychecks. The Republicans wanted this as well. Nancy Pelosi is going to brag about getting an extra $100 billion for it. I got news for you. There's $150 billion sitting unused in that right now. That money was, there was no projection that that money was needed because you only have one bite at the apple. There's only so many businesses out there. So they came in, they did it in a day. You need this, Republicans? We're going to say a little bit more. We're going to give you a little bit more of what you already want, but we're not going to use the leverage we have. And here's how she's addressing. And this is Jake Tapper who sees this problem.
Right. You and Senator Schumer made this major concession on the most recent legislation because you made it okay in this one. For the,
it wasn't a concession.
No. Well, I mean, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
I understand what Andrew Cuomo said, and I respect his perspective as a governor. But the fact is this. They wanted $250 for the PPP. We support the PPP. We're part of developing it. Small business is entrepreneurial, part of the optimism of America. So we're for that. But we wanted to include more people and more money for the program and for the hospital. So it was an interim bill. It was always an interim bill. We always said that CARES 2 would be the bill where we would go to, for state and local.
Right.
And we will in a big way.
I get that, but I just want to play for you the sound from New York Governor Cuomo, because he said he needs money for his state to save New York from an economic tsunami. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We've been talking about funding for state and local governments, and it was not in the bill that the House is going to pass today. They said, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry, the next bill. I said to my colleagues in Washington, I would have insisted that state and local funding was in this current bill, because I don't believe they want to fund state and local governments.
So Cuomo says he would have insisted on state funding in the last bill. And now Senator McConnell is saying he wants to push the pause button. Was this a tactical mistake by you and Senator Schumer?
Just calm down. We will have state and local, and we will have it in a very significant way. It's no use going on to what might have been. The administration never even wanted to do. Let me recap this for you. When we said we're not doing 250.
Okay, you don't need to hear anymore. All right, there it is. Andrew Cuomo clearly understood what was going on in Washington, D.C. There were other people who had been saying that since CARES 1. CARES 2, incidentally, never happened. That clip is from 4.5 months ago. And we're not going to, not only is it not going to happen tomorrow, it's not going to happen next month. It's not going to happen the month after. It's not going to happen during, this is the best case scenario. It's not going to happen during the lame duck period. This is assuming that Joe Biden wins. The earliest we're going to see this, any support, a dollar for cities or states, is going to be sometime in March of 2020. That's the earliest possible, because not only do you have to go through the House with this city and state stuff, you're going to have to go through a Senate, which is at the very least is going to filibuster it. So then you got to convince Chris Coons to get rid of the filibuster. And then you got to go back again and you got to get the thing passed. And that dollar's going to get out the door. We're not going to see this until March, almost a year after she said these words. Best case scenario. So, and Shahid, I got to let you speak. I'm sorry, but this gets me so.
Speak on, brother.
that you're obviously not going to be Speaker of the House. But if you get elected, Nancy Pelosi will not be Speaker of the House. And I don't care if it's Paul Ryan who gets in there, because Paul Ryan doesn't have the ability to shut down debate like she did over the past 6 months over this thing, because he doesn't have the institutional. She's been there for decades. She was, you know, over 15 years ago was the Speaker of the House. So I would rather someone who's weaker in terms of their ability to maintain their own power. Even if they don't agree with me, because cities and states are going to be destroyed, and that's going to impact millions of people living in poverty, homelessness. It's going to impact food security. It's going to impact health insurance. Education, teachers, unions. I mean, we're looking at a tsunami here, it seems to me.
It is catastrophic. And it's needlessly catastrophic. And you're absolutely right in drawing attention to what I describe as one of the core rationales for our campaign. And that is to ensure that Nancy Pelosi is not the Speaker of the House in the next session of Congress. And the failures of the House and the House leadership with her holding the gavel, I dare say, are inexcusable. And you've noted some of them. It's just to note here, there are two different points at which Nancy Pelosi in the last several months has just profoundly conceded any authority and influence to the right wing. The first of them, you noted, and that was the passage of the first stimulus bill, giving away more or less everything that the GOP wanted without insisting on anything that our communities needed. The second was the more recent CR. And this idea that somehow Nancy Pelosi...
That's a continuing resolution that allows the government to open. She has made an agreement with Mnuchin to just do a clean, we'll keep the government open.
No stimulus, no rent and mortgage relief, no UBI, no support for state and local governments, none of that stuff, right? And the idea, she gets a lot of credit from people, you know, centrist liberals who think that she's strong because she tears up a speech or claps sideways. But the voting record, the policy record suggests that the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, the most powerful Democrat in Washington, is Donald Trump's greatest enabler on Capitol Hill. And I've known this. I've watched it. I've watched Nancy Pelosi's active complicity in the authoritarianism that has emerged in the last 20 years. I'm very aware of the poignance of today's anniversary and how it indicates her long-running complicity. But and for instance, the color of the sky in San Francisco this week and the issues that it presents. But just to stay focused on the coronavirus stimulus packages, in addition to the state and local governments, which you're absolutely right to focus on, they are more or less the source of the greatest support that working families and Americans can get because our federal social services layer has so eroded under the generation of policymakers of whom Nancy Pelosi is a part. Not only are the state and local governments facing preventable crises, but I really want to focus on the struggling local people and communities. There is an eviction wave that's been building and accelerating across the country. Many states have had measures in place like an eviction moratorium, which we've had here in San Francisco or in California across the state, but they're not indefinite. And it would have been great if one of the early coronavirus stimulus measures ensured that millions of Americans who are struggling to put food on the table wouldn't have to worry about putting food in the street because the economy had to be shut down in order to guard public health. But that's not what happened. In fact, in the early coronavirus stimulus measures, what did get included, and this is very revealing, are tax breaks for millionaires. Nancy Pelosi prioritized tax breaks of $1.6 million each for tax filers who earn over $1 million a year. And there's not a penny of rent or mortgage relief. And there's a bill on the table that would keep millions of people in their homes, that would allow people to sleep at night, who I think their anxieties on top of their everything else might be difficult to deal with. And those weren't prioritized. I see similarly UBI. I noticed an article this morning that France recently decided to extend its support program, direct cash payments to residents through the summer of 2021. And in the United States, we've had two one-time payments of $1,200 for some tax filers, most of whom haven't gotten it. The PPP, which Nancy Pelosi was bragging about on that clip, her own husband was a beneficiary. He's a part owner of a hotel in Northern California. Her own husband got a PPP loan for his business worth over $1 million. And I've talked to small business owners who haven't been able to navigate the Byzantine process to gain access to it. So even the PPP was, which as you noted, has unspent funds, was something of a racket. And she's talking about the optimism of America. The optimism of America is making sure that people can get medicine if they're sick. That's what you show up for if you care about optimism in America, or making sure that we don't have a sky that's poisonous to literally millions of people who live up and down the West Coast. That would support the optimism in America. And my favorite part of the clip that you shared is where Nancy Pelosi says, well, there's no point in debating what could have been. And with all due respect to the speaker, we live in a democracy, and there's a great deal of point in assessing what might have been, because even if she doesn't seem to realize it, she's accountable to the residents of San Francisco, and she faces a Democrat in the November election for the first time in her career, during which, incidentally, she has never, not once, shown up for a debate against a challenger. It's been 30 years since she went to the House. She's never debated a challenger. And she says there's no point to looking at her record. I respectfully, but also emphatically, would beg to differ. There's a great deal of point to looking at the record of incumbents. It's called democracy, and the speaker might want to get acquainted with it. And I'm eager to acquaint her with it in a few months.
I just want to clarify something for people who don't understand how California works. California has what is known, I guess, as a jungle primary, where there is it is not based upon parties. Everybody goes in there, and the top two vote getters end up meeting in the general election. So you have instances, theoretically, you could have a Republican running against a Republican in a general election. You could have a Republican versus a Democrat. And in this instance, we have two Democrats running. So just want to make it clear. There's no spoiler situation here. There's no, none of that is a question. There is going to be a Democrat who is going to be sitting as a congressperson from the 12th district of California. The question is it going to be you or Pelosi? And again, I also just want to remind people, because I know there's some people out there like, what about the Republicans? Yes, the Republicans are not going to pass anything except for unless you have what they want, which had already been given away. And it's really the second time. Like you say, the continuing resolution, I guess people can debate as to who's going to take more of the blame if the government doesn't go forward. But it seems to me that there is at least there should be a debate as to whether it is powerful for the Democrats to say, we need to provide for the American public, and nothing goes forward without that. You don't have the ability to degrade the Department of Justice. You don't have the ability to degrade OSHA. You don't have the ability to send our kids back to school without the protections for teachers that are needed. You don't have the ability to, go on and on. I mean, it's very easy to develop this rhetoric. And we're not going to stand for it until you fund these things to help the American public, just because you think that Joe Biden's going to be president and you're going to already start the obstruction now. That's not going to happen. We're not going to participate in that. There is a game that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are playing. And that is, how do we thread this needle? How do we at once not empower Donald Trump to help the American public and get credit for it and hurt our chances of beating him in the election, which, you know, I think there is an argument that the most important thing that Donald Trump loses, because it's going to be a crap show if he gets another 4 years. I think there's some valid arguments to that.
Clearly.
But instead of using all their resources to do that, they also protect their other flank, which says, how do we do that without promising stuff that would go contrary to what our corporate benefactors want in the event that we're in a position to deliver it. So yeah, that's why you get things like subsidized COBRA, which is not a benefit for the American public. It's not fiscally responsible. It is a way of saying that we're doing something, but it's not in any way holding us to any type of promise that we're actually going to do something that's going to fundamentally help the American public after the fact. I mean, so even if we put aside the fact that she didn't use leverage when she had it, that just strategically and tactically, she failed. Put aside an ideology, she failed in that regard. Then there's this other game where she's basically not using all of the feathers in the arrows in the quiver, because she's afraid that those arrows run contrary to the interests of some of her corporate benefactors. And we may actually have to deploy those arrows if Joe Biden wins. And that's reprehensible.
The place where I see that dynamic you're describing, leaving cards on the table to support corporate benefactors, where I see that get most poignant was before all this, before the pandemic even started. It was in the impeachment process, where we could have included corruption. Mm-hmm. That would have brought the president down. Corruption offends Americans across the political spectrum, unlike the partisan crime that she chose to limit the process to, right? Corruption could have brought down the president. She affirmatively removed it from the objects of consideration. Jerry Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has made this point himself publicly. It was Nancy Pelosi who said that Trump will not be forced to answer for his corruption. And that is another example of, you know, taking a very important argument off the table, basically because it placed corporate Democrats and their corporate benefactors at political risk. And the idea that the political risk to corporate benefactors or industries or corporate Democrats, for that matter, should outweigh the dire existential crises facing our country is frankly preposterous. And it's not like there's just one crisis. right? It's not like there's just a climate catastrophe unfolding, or just a global pandemic, or just an economic collapse. I mean, I saw a study this week about the rates of suicide ideation among young people. Something like 1 in 4 people below the age of 30 has seriously considered taking their life in the last 6 months. And that's amazing. And an amazing demonstration of failure. We cannot allow policies that drive entire generations to think about taking themselves to early graves. It just seems so preposterous to me that anyone would consider the status quo as viable or tenable or sustainable, given reflections like that. And the failures of leadership here have been up and down the line. You know, to your point about the strategic and tactical failure, and then the ideological co-optation, I would maybe describe as that second point that you're raising. Corporate Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, fight the left and working American families struggling with the cost of this pandemic far harder than they've ever fought the president. They'll theatrically resist the president while paving his path in policy. And we, the people of the United States, trying to get medicine in the middle of a pandemic or trying to stay in our homes while the economy is shut down, Congress, led by Nancy Pelosi, basically gave America the middle finger because they're more interested in looking out for themselves and, again, those industries that they protect. Just to bring it into the mix, because it's hard for me not to think about this today, is the defense industry, so-called defense industry. And the anniversary of today seems to bring into play. So, and that's one of the, for me, existential, not just reasons for my campaign, but even why I'm an American. You know, my family fled the impacts of the U.S. military industrial complex on democracies abroad. The democracy in my native country was repeatedly toppled by military coups supported by the United States. And it was those military governments that my family fled, going to England in the 60s. And then my family came to the U.S. in the 70s. I wouldn't be an American if it weren't for the serial crimes of our military industrial complex. And that also have been driven by these industrial interests. You know, Eisenhower put it in those terms when he forecast what ultimately came to be. So I'm just bringing that. And then maybe the other industry to put on the table here is all the ones related to fossil fuel extraction. The corporate Democrats are owned by industry, and it's why we call them corporate Democrats, and their policies reflect it. And the idea that we are forced to choose at a time like this between outright unrepentant fascists and people who put corporate interests before our communities, one reason that's so dangerous is that fascism supports the market. That role of corporate Democrats paves the road for fascism, because to your point, if we don't have alternative voices saying to people, and this is one reason I supported Senator Sanders for the presidency, if we don't have alternative voices that are actually meeting people where we are at and meeting their needs, populations and electorates become very susceptible to the allure of right-wing populism, because it preys on dejection. It preys on fear and anxiety. It preys on insufficiency. It preys on crisis. And because corporate Democrats have done nothing to actually address the real crises confronting our people, it primes the pump for Trump and his criminal ilk. And as much as I fear this president, you know, I fear what he has unleashed far more. And what he has unleashed, I fear, will be the defining characteristic of our generation. Our generation's project is to put that genie back in the bottle and reassert a vision of America that includes all people, that has respect for workers, that has respect for minorities, that doesn't degrade, other countries as, you know, I mean, I can't even repeat the president's terms. It's just so vile, right, what we see in Washington today, and we can't take it, and we can't take the actors who claim falsely to resist it while tacitly, and in some cases, too many cases in the example of corporate Democrats, actively supporting the policy paradigm.
You know, there was that performative aspect. The other day, Nancy Pelosi tweeted out something to the effect of, "The president, you lied and people died." All well,
I remember that.
True. And I just added a link to that interview with Jake Tapper, because that to me was just, you know, indicative of both how indignant she was about the criticism she was getting. It pointed out that there was criticism that was contemporaneous, that people could predict how the Republican Party was going to act and could assess what their agenda was.
Yep.
And it also indicates her either disingenuousness or cluelessness as to how this was all going to play out. And I don't know which one it was, and it really doesn't matter.
Same.
But the performative is not enough. And for people who criticize me by saying, like, you're doing both sides-ism, and the most important thing is to get rid of Donald Trump. I agree the most important thing is to get rid of Donald Trump. There is not a single voter in the country who is contemplating switching from supporting Donald Trump to supporting Joe Biden, who is going to listen to Nancy Pelosi, with all due respect. Nancy Pelosi has allowed herself to become villainized by the Republican Party because it strengthens her support within the Democratic Party. This is a very obvious technique that anybody who is a YouTuber up to, you know, like, a despot understands that you know, having an outside enemy rallies people around you. And it is not helping the Democratic Party win. She is maintaining her own power. And things like, if you're challenging a sitting Democrat in the House, you are blacklisted. But I will support Joe Kennedy, yes, going against Ed Markey. And why? Because Ed Markey joined AOC in supporting the Green New Deal, which she is fundamentally against. People can remember those first month in 2018 when the Democrats swept into power and Nancy Pelosi fought tooth and nail to make sure there was no talk of Green New Deal. She made sure there was no talk of Medicare for all. None of these things, which poll after poll, you had Stanley Greenberg, who is a longtime Democratic pollster, not an ideologue, not a leftist in any measurable way, just like a straight down the middle Democrat who's basically done poll after poll, focus group after focus group, would show if you want to win, you offer healthcare in a meaningful way. And now all you got to do is look to the north. If you're in San Francisco and you see a blood red sky, and the idea that the Democrats do not have a fully articulated vision of healthcare, not just for the 10 million people who are eligible to go into the ACA exchanges around the country, but for every American in the country to make it cheaper for them. And they don't have a fully articulated vision, a comprehensive one, which where they're all on the same page, where they can point to the sky in the north of California and say, see that blood red sky? That is the new norm, and we need to do something about it. The fact that we are absent of that at this time may not preclude us from defeating one of the most hated presidents in the history of the country. But when 2022 rolls around and when 2024 rolls around, we could be looking at President Tom Cotton. We could be looking at a Republican Senate and House. I mean, it's not enough to every 4 years get a couple of years worth of ability to create legislature, because we've now seen what happened to Obama's accomplishments to the extent that they were. You need to have a durable victory, and to have a durable victory, you need to actually provide stuff that the public wants. And that is not inconsistent with defeating what I consider to be one of the greatest threats to the country that certainly been alive in my lifetime. And I lived through Nixon, for God's sakes.
I'm with you. I mean, this point about the need to remove Donald Trump from the White House, precluding any attention to the further things we need to do, is frankly silly. We do need to remove Donald Trump from the White House. And if we mean seriously to address any of our crises, we have to also change some people in Congress. It's not enough.
They're not mutually exclusive ideas. In fact, they work with each other.
Precisely. To your point, if we showed up for the policies supported by a majority of the American people, like Medicare for All, that would help the Democratic nominee win the race. There's a reason that Senator Sanders was supported so widely. If you look, there's a map that the New York Times used to publish that showed who was the leading fundraiser among the presidential candidates in each part of the country. And it revealed that by far, Bernie was the most supported candidate. And you might say that suggests interesting, maybe hypocritical things about a party that calls itself Democratic while nominating a nominee with demonstrably less support. And, you know, yes, we could chalk that up to the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. Yes, we could talk about how that places the American people and our entire democracy at risk. given who's in the White House and his aspirations to implement his own form of not constitutional government. But beyond all that, you know, I just see this abdication of the need to represent the people. Theoretically, legislators are representatives. They are there to represent us. And what corporate Democrats have not done at all is that. And I think to your point, it not only places the race to remove Trump at risk by failing to meet people where they're at and conceding this ground of outrage and concern to right-wing populists who claim, at least, even if they don't, in fact, stand in solidarity with working people. This is the allure of right-wing populism under an age of corporate rule. Because people are actually struggling with real crises, they want to throw the bums out. And when you have oligarchs and tyrants present themselves as outsiders, that's exactly what Donald Trump did. It's very dangerous because people want outsiders because they recognize that the insiders have been fleecing us for decades. And Nancy Pelosi's been part of that. You know, when you talk about the blood red sky in San Francisco, one thing I think that's really important to note is that the environmental crises here long preceded this week. They long preceded the drought that sparked wildfires in the last several years. Hunters Point is a neighborhood here in San Francisco. It's in the southeastern corner of the city. It's one of our last remaining black enclaves, and it's been poisoned by the U.S. Navy for decades. It's the site where they built the nuclear bombs that were tested in the South Pacific before the use of weapons of mass destruction in Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the U.S. military. So before we committed mass atrocities, we were testing these bombs in the South Pacific, and we were poisoning an entire neighborhood across San Francisco where the breast cancer rates and the asthma rates are among the worst in the world. And that was long before the sky turned red. And the idea that the political establishment in Washington is able to ignore these issues of public health and environmental racism, to me, it's really poignant because the Speaker of the House represents this city. And these issues around environmental racism and justice and toxicity and public health, they've been there for decades. And it would be great if Hunter's Point had a powerful member of Congress to do something about it, but our very powerful member of Congress from San Francisco, at least, has had other priorities, like passing tax breaks for
right. Let's get the salt deductions back on and just to be clear on what those salt deductions are, they are for wealthy people who were able to deduct their because they own a very maybe expensive house, like maybe in San Francisco. I can deduct my property taxes from my federal taxes. This is a tax deduction that goes, I think 60 to 80% of it go to people who are making, I think, over $1 million or somewhere around there, or have over $1 million worth of wealth. And that was a huge issue. And I understand, you know, the argument that it precludes, blue states from taxing, but I don't think there's any data to support that, frankly. But I understand that argument. But you know, the bottom line, it's just a question of priorities. And here, let me give one more example before we go to the break into the fun half. I make the argument that Nancy Pelosi can set markers that can actually help people, even though the Republicans aren't going to pass it, and she won't do that. Because she is co-opted by, like you say, ideological and corporate interests, and does not want to set a marker and create this is called managing expectations. Sure. We want to make sure that the Democratic Party, that you, the Democratic voter, do not expect your own party to deliver what you want them to deliver. And so instead of, I don't know, a Medicare buy-in, we're going to subsidize your coming into Medicare, which would be far more fiscally responsible than we're going to subsidize the most expensive insurance product there is, COBRA, and we're going to just, all the money is just going to go into the insurance industry. There was a vote in the Senate on what they call the skinny coronavirus relief. It was a crappy little bill that the Democrats were right to reject. I don't even think the Republicans were terribly interested in it passing anyways. They just want to be able to say they brought up something. And this kabuki theater that they have around corporate indemnification for any lawsuits so that they can open up their whatever it is, their businesses, and not get sued by people because they did so in a way that endangered their workers and their customers.
What this means for essential workers is scandalous, and no one's talking about it. I'm so glad you're raising this, because behind the corporate indemnification, is basically carte blanche to not only abuse workers, but place public health at risk. I mean, I think about the meatpacking plants in particular, where we've had these outbreaks. And this is, it's not just a right-wing corporate subsidy. It's a corporate subsidy that invites predictable public health crises, as if we don't have enough already.
Well, we want to talk about a profile in Courage. Nancy Pelosi can't come out and say that she's for any type of expansion of healthcare. But Chris Coons, the number one surrogate for Joe Biden, not just in the Senate, he was, anytime I was on MSNBC and they needed a Biden wasn't available. They had the other candidates. They didn't have Biden. They would bring Chris Coons on. He was a group, this is according to the realsludge.com. Coons was a, and he honed, he, I guess he holds Joe Biden's former Senate seat, was among a small group of Democrats in May that called for corporate immunity, which the Hill described as a crack in Democratic unity that gives Republicans in the White House some leverage. Coons said he wanted liability protections for businesses included in the next coronavirus bill, along with health and safety guidelines for businesses that would be required to follow. The simplest and most powerful solution to liability protection is to have a science-based blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, liability protection. You know what the way to, you know, if you're worried about that, then you have the liability adjudicated in the courts. But the big thing for him is he has a big hedge fund who are big supporters of his who own a lot of nursing homes. And the nursing home industry is rightfully very concerned that they have been cutting corners for an extended period of time for the health and safety of their clients. And their
customers, yeah.
And their customers.
And their families.
And their families. And a lot of people died in nursing homes. Probably the primary source of the deaths in this country, and including, I would imagine, the workers at these things. So here is Chris Coons, who is basically pushing this Republican initiative, and he's willing to come out and do it and suffer the slings and arrows. It does not make sense. There is no way that Chris Coons is running on this. The Democrats have at their disposal a lot of things they could bring out. They are just afraid to do it because they don't want to set a marker. But somehow Chris Coons manages to set that marker for himself going into this election. It gives you a sense that at the very least, you're being played by this. And that's not to say that Democrats are as bad as Republicans, because there are Democrats who are arguing against Nancy Pelosi. There's a Democrat sitting right there running against Nancy Pelosi who disagrees with her fundamentally on all these issues. But it is to say that the Democratic Party, there are elements of the Democratic Party that are preventing and are there to prevent the real change that would empower Democrats for generations in a way that we saw after Social Security, in a way that we saw after things like Medicare. There are Democrats who are preventing this because their maintenance of power is primary. And the maintenance of power by Democrats, and Democrats standing as a party that provides for people what they want and need, is secondary to them. Maybe even tertiary. I don't know what comes in between. But Shahid, we're going to take a break.
Yep.
We're going to go into the fun half, where I will be less strident and I will allow you to talk more. We will go through some of the clips of the insanity that's going on, and talk a little bit about the insanity that I anticipate happening. And we're starting to see it from now until the election, and then perhaps the one afterwards. I should just tell people, I interviewed David Dayen on Ring of Fire this week. He has an amazing piece called The Winter of Our Discontent, talking about the next 78 days, or I should say the 78 days starting from the election to the inauguration. I cannot encourage you to read that piece enough, and to listen to the Ring of Fire interview with David Dayen. We're going to have him on this program probably at the beginning of October to talk about the same thing, because it is so important that people are aware of what is going to take place. Not definitely, but more than likely. And we can talk a little bit about this on the other side. This election, and we're seeing it yesterday where the Wisconsin State Supreme Court basically said, we're going to hold up on the absentee ballots because there's some question here. It's a conservative court. It was a conservative decision. They're going to hold up on the absentee ballots, which is going to have a ripple effect. So when those ballots don't come in on time, they're going to say, well, you know, it's not our fault, but it will be because they are sent out late. That is just the beginning, and it's the most benign version of what we're going to see, I believe, starting close to Election Day, in terms of shutting down the counting in different places, different courts shutting stuff down, Bill Barr activating, the Proud Boys, I think like the whole kit and caboodle. And it's very important that every single person who is invested in the outcome of this election be aware of what could possibly happen and what could be required of people, because we're going to have to get into the streets. We're going to have to be aware and make people aware of what's going on with the courts, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to be ugly. I'm convinced of it. Check out that interview with David Dayan on Ring of Fire. If you want to support this program, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie, 6-7 minutes of headline news in the morning. Totally free. You can find that at amquickie.com or any of your podcast descriptions. Don't forget, check out Nomiki's show. She is now going 4 days a week. Right after the show at 3 p.m. Check that out. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Hey, so this week on the Antifada, we had on Brace Belden of the TrueAnon podcast to talk about the history of labor organizing in the United States, the role played by communists in the militant labor movement, and what people can do now to bring some of that power back, the idea of the party, what is a workers' party, what kind of organization do we need to be building, etc., etc. That went out on Wednesday for everyone. And then today we released a bonus where Brace and the guys talk a little bit about punk rock and what they like to listen to growing up as young punks. So that's out now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, I should say, I went on the Nomi Key show yesterday to talk about socialist feminism. We had a little panel discussion on it, and that is still up now for anyone who wants to watch it.
Check that out. Matt, what's happening on TMBS?
Yeah, TMBS this Tuesday, we had Milton Alamadi of Black Star News. We talked about the coup in Mali, and then Uganda's Museveni is sort of like the prototypical imperial puppet, and his sort of Trump-like attacks on his opponent in that election, Bobby Wine. He's saying he's actually 40 when he claims he's 38. So that's the sort of level of politics that he's engaging in. So yeah, patreon.com/TMBS, and then twitch.tv/literary hangover. I'm playing Flight Simulator. So probably do that this weekend.
Okay, great. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.